Hey, everybody, this is Ben Bowman. Welcome back to another episode of The Oregon Bridge.
Kind of a common narrative right now in the city of Portland is like random violence that finds people on the street. You know, every corner of the city looked to me like it was in crisis. And that's when the mayor and his team asked me to come on and basically run lead on trying to recover some aspect of downtown's livability. I think we have got to get serious about more action on the ground. And I think that the politic of Portland, meaning like all of us as people, has hit the point where we're willing to say, I'm not willing to put up with that anymore. Ultimately, I am definitely betting on Portland.
All right, folks. Today was a fun episode. I have talked about before in this podcast how one of the cool things about hosting a podcast is you get to talk to cool people who you otherwise wouldn't get to talk to. Today is not such an episode. And the reason why it's not such an episode is because I got to interview a friend of mine named Eric Zimmerman. And it was also a super interesting interview that I think you all will really enjoy. Eric's had a very interesting career in public service. He's worked as chief of staff to two different Multnomah County commissioners. He's worked for the mayor of Portland on basically saving downtown. He serves in the National Guard at a relatively high rank and has for 16 years. And he's also worked in like nonpartisan city administration as an assistant city manager in a couple of different cities, including the great city of Tigard. And as you'll hear in the episode, he's also just a very thoughtful and interesting person. So in this episode, we talk about Portland, of course. I ask him what he thinks the vibe is in Portland. I ask him what he thinks Portland needs. He is a rumored candidate for Portland City Council. He was in the Willamette Week as a potential candidate. So we talk a little bit about that. And we also talk about his service in the military. We talk a little bit about Multnomah County Commission, what a chief of staff to a commissioner actually does. And we even touch on some world events, global politics at the end of the episode. I will note before we get into the episode, Eric is on this podcast in his personal capacity. He is not representing his boss at the Multnomah County Commission in this episode. He's not representing the United States federal government or military in this episode. He is speaking only for himself. But with that, thank you all for listening. I know you'll enjoy this episode, and we'll get right into the interview with Eric Zimmerman.
Now that the legislative session is over, it's time for Oregon's activists, candidates, and political committees to turn their attention to the 2024 elections. With government regulation of political activities becoming more complicated nearly every year, and with political actors increasingly initiating complaints and litigation to achieve political goals, having experienced legal counsel has become critical to success in the political arena. Harang Long PC has represented clients involved in candidate and ballot measure elections for decades. To learn more about Harang Long's political law practice, check out our website at harang.com. That's www.harrang.com.
All right, Eric Zimmerman, welcome to the podcast. How are you?
I'm good. Hi, Ben. It's good to see you tonight.
It's good to see you too. Thanks for joining a late night podcast recording. Okay, so you're a very interesting person, Eric. You've worked in lots of different roles. You've done different things in your life. You've traveled all over the place. You have lots of opinions. I think I want to start, when I think of you, one of the first things I think of is your military service in the Guard. How'd you get involved in the National Guard? And can you explain what your rank is and what that means for an audience who might not be super familiar with military ranks?
Sure. So, I mean, the spirit of the National Guard is that the grand majority of us are just normal people in the community, and every single state has a National Guard, and we generally have a full-time job doing other stuff. And so I work with people who are students. I work with people who are, you know, lawyers and doctors and carpentry, everything you can think of, teachers. And then a couple of days a month, usually on the weekend, we come in and we put our uniforms on, and I shave this beard because I have to be out of the beard for a uniform, and we fulfill our reserve duties as part of the Guard. And so my rank in the Guard is I'm a major. So I'm an officer, and in that I'm a major. My role right now is the role is called executive officer. It's like the second ranking person in a battalion of engineers out of Salem. So it's a great unit. I've been in the Oregon Guard my whole career, which is over 16 years now. But the way I got into the Guard, you know, I was like a lot of college students. I think people have seen on their college campuses going to ROTC, right? And I did that, and it was I started college a few months after the United States went into Iraq in 2003. And so I started college, was through at that time. When we got to the end of my college time, you know, that traditionally with ROTC, then you take your commission, right? They've given you a scholarship. They take your commission as a second lieutenant because now you have your bachelor's degree and you go into the active duty. And if you think about in 2007, there was, you know, still a law in the books called Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
That's right.
And so for me,
God, that's so wild to think about. It feels like right. That's ancient history, but that's literally like not that long ago.
It's not that long ago. And for me being a person, like other things you figure out in college that you're gay, right? And so like, here I am feeling a little bit pinched because I've got this thing and, you know, you kind of start coming out in college, but it was always a secret, you know, outside of my closest circle. And so I was really pretty concerned about being found out by the military, not really the rest of my life, but by the military, and then like being fired or having to pay back the scholarship that I, because I went to the University of Portland. It's a very expensive private school. So I was concerned about that, but I also had a feeling that the world was already changing a little bit. And I had a feeling that I would be safer with that topic in the Guard. And so, you know, the Guard is, until we're federalized and until we're activated for federal missions, our commander in chief is the governor of any given state. And I just made a calculation that I would go into the Guard instead of the active duty. And I just did not expect that a Democratic governor and a general appointed by a Democratic governor would necessarily push that unless I gave them a deep reason to. And so I kind of made a calculation at the time, and that's really how I found the Guard. And so then I've had a regular career since then as well, but I do both simultaneously.
We've talked, and we'll talk about your other career in a moment, but we've talked before about military service. It's something that I find really interesting and appealing, but also really challenging. One thing that I think about, we've probably talked about this before. So you served in the Guard. So you've been sent overseas for Guard work. Have you been federalized?
I have. So I deployed to the Iraq War and to a NATO peacekeeping mission in Kosovo in the south of Europe. And then also I did duty for a lay person to understand, like you've heard the term like defense attaché probably in embassies. I was like an assistant to the assistant attaché.
You're the Dwight Schrute of the organization.
Yeah, exactly. Always trying to be that assistant manager. No, so I did that at our U.S. embassy in Bangladesh in South Asia most recently. So I've definitely been federalized a few times. And the Guard, it is not like a hard and fast, like you are or not active or not. It really has to do with what we can do by title, like Title 10, Title 32. Those change our rules. And then I've also been activated for state. Like I commanded a task force of forest firefighters out in Northeast Oregon in 2015, when right as that season was really getting going. And that was state, right? The governor called me up for that, right? In that situation.
So here's the thing that I would love to hear you reflect on, because you're a Democrat, you're on the progressive side of the aisle. How do you've obviously served in the military during times where you probably disagreed with U.S. foreign policy, or you probably disagreed with the president of the United States on a personal level or on a political level, but your mission is a higher calling than that. So how do you navigate even internally your sort of purpose and your oath and your duty to country and like your own perspective about what we should or shouldn't be doing and how we should be doing it?
Yeah. I mean, the Army for me has been, it's actually been really easy in that thing, right? We think that maybe that would be a complicating factor, but the United States is really unique in the world because when I raised my hand to take the oath, that oath sounds very much like every other officer within the United States government's oath. The only difference is that at a point they say the office in which you're being appointed, but we're all taking the same oath, and it is an oath to the Constitution. It is, what's unique about that is it is not an oath to a person.
That's right.
And so my status as an officer doesn't change based on a political party. It doesn't change based on my being a member of that party or the president being of a different party. And it doesn't change based on the conflict or the war that we're facing or the foreign policy that we're debating at the time. So that makes it easy for people like me if we do find a moment where personally we have reservations, or even if we have, you know, if we're really jazzed up about something, we think it's the right place to be. I think holding our tongue on certain things and holding our zeal in certain ways is important because we have to be trustworthy for the next person who comes in. Whatever the party is, whatever the politics are of the session, we've got to be able to be just as loyal to the orders that we get from the next person. And so that's been, it's been actually really easy to maintain that. And I've found that with my colleagues as well. And I think we try to be highly aware of current events, but we try not to be too deeply in discussions about politics, right? And politics as they relate to the humans involved, like by name, right? That kind of stuff.
That's right.
And that's helpful. And then the other piece, like at a much lower level, you can debate the importance, the right or wrong of a war zone you get sent to. But when you're there, it really doesn't matter, because you have a way different duty and a thought and a care that has to do with the people that you're with. And
yeah.
I joined the Army because, unlike some of the other services, the Army, I think, is probably the most people-focused service, right? We don't win things by having the most technologically advanced system. We don't win things by having a really fast airplane. Like, we win things because of people, right? Mm-hmm. Having 100 people behind you, having 100 people in a formation, human interaction, like that stuff, I really enjoy that a lot. And the Army has handed me many jobs that I had no idea how to do them, but we figure it out as an Army. So that, when you're in the moment, the people part is way more important than the foreign policy. You keep that in your mind, but I think most people would reflect a similar thing. It's like, that's what matters in the moment.
You're a very patriotic person, and we appreciate your service. Okay, so you've served your country in that way and continue to serve your country in that way. But you also are in service to your local community in your other career, your full-time career. You're currently chief of staff to a Multnomah County commissioner. You were previously a chief of staff to a different Multnomah County commissioner. You've worked in municipal government. You work for the greatest city in the state of Oregon, actually. Fun fact about you. You were assistant city manager. Is that right, for Tigard?
I did. And I wore this sweatshirt just for you, the TVFNR community event or community training that I went through for TVFNR when I was at the city of Tigard. Yeah.
Tell us about that work. I think here's the question that I'll tee up for you. We did an interview with Nick Blosser that people really liked, where it was like, what does a governor's chief of staff do? And I was thinking, like, for you, it's interesting because Nick Blosser is chief of staff to a CEO of a state. Like, there's a lot of control and power that's vested in his principal, his boss. In the legislature, a chief of staff is a lot different. It's a lot different role, legislative chief of staff, than governor's chief of staff. And I have never worked in county government. I read newspaper articles about county government, and that's about the extent of my expertise. But my perception from working with county commissioners and staff is that it's kind of a almost like a mix somewhere in between the CEO and the legislative. But like, how would you describe your job as chief of staff to a county commissioner?
Yeah, it certainly won't be nearly as interesting as Nick Blosser's. I listened to that podcast. That was a great interview, by the way. And he's at a level that, you know, one should aspire to be. So, you know, I think it is certainly a hybrid of both those systems, the legislative and, I'll say, the on the ground, because we certainly don't have an executive role as a county commissioner and as a staff to one. Because in Multnomah County, I think it could be argued that the chair in Multnomah County might be the most empowered executive elected position in the state of Oregon. And if you really look at how strong, like, we've heard of the term strong mayor.
Yeah.
Let me tell you, the chair of Multnomah County is the strongest elected chair or mayor that I can think of in the state of Oregon, and doesn't have a legislature like the governor has that is also right there. So it's a remarkable position.
Is that a good thing? Is that a good design in your opinion? You've worked really closely there. Like, there's all this debate in the city of Portland government transition. Like, how much power should the mayor have? What you're describing is the opposite of where they landed. What do you think
of
that dynamic?
I generally think, so if you were to make this about the city of Portland, I generally think the public looks to their mayor to be a strong mayor, right? In crisis, nobody knows who the city manager is. Nobody knows who the city administrator is, the county manager, especially in your largest community of the state. Because generally in your largest city, these are full-time jobs for elected officials. And so there's an importance there that I actually think it can be valuable. You know, the Charter Commission at the city of Portland landed in more of a hybrid. They have a full-time mayor, kind of like Beaverton has a full-time mayor, but they've kind of split up the relational duties and the day-to-day operational duties between a city manager. And Portland's kind of getting into that. They'll figure it out. I value it. I think it's good. I think Multnomah County should be that way. I think it's an important role for the chair. And in Multnomah County has over 800,000 residents. It's the largest county population-wise. It's a full-time role. It's important that it's a full-time role. It's a, you know, $3.7 billion budget. And then that chair has four colleagues of county commissioners, of which I work for one, and I've worked for another one before in a previous administration. And our role as county commissioners, one of five, is very much budgetary and constituent relations. And they are the mini, you know, they're the legislative body for the county. So, you know, ordinances and resolutions and all that normal stuff. So my role, what I like about the, and what we do get involved at the county in how things are executed, how things are run day to day, because it's a small body. So the chair asks for the input of her colleagues in our case, and asks for, especially if a certain project or a certain type of implementation, it seems particularly important to an elected, maybe that's their niche issue. Maybe it's an area they have deep expertise in. Good chairs lean on the expertise that they've got in their commission. So my role is, a lot of times it's working with my other chiefs of staff who are my colleagues, and the government relations that exist between offices. You know, there are four other offices you've got to make sure you get to, and three votes governs, right? So there's a bit of counting votes at the time. There's trying to, and most of the time it's negotiating aspects of various budget packages. So a little bit for, so enough people are there to be happy that that's moving in a direction that as a body they can agree on. And everybody does it different, right? I've worked for a person who's highly confident and capable in her own media stuff. But in a previous role, I handled all media for an elected. Oftentimes, I'll go to events or go to meetings or go to other critical things instead of the commissioner, just because there's so much going on. And so we kind of split the district, so to speak. And I also, I come with my own portfolio expertise, my own time in the mayor's office in the city of Portland. And so for us, we balance off one another, and we both try to achieve the, you know, three or four things that are like our guiding principles of her tenure here, as it's part of the larger county administration. So it's a job that changes every day, but you try to keep a few like guiding principles, guiding lights, and what's important and what you have time to get done.
So in between stints as chief of staff to a county commissioner, you made a run for office of your own. What made you want to cross over into the candidate side of things?
Yeah. You know, I had worked at Multnomah County for 9 years at that point. The commissioner that I was working for was term limited. I was also, you know, Multnomah County has a unique form of government where we designate alternates in case a person cannot fulfill the rest of their term. I was Jules Bailey's alternate in District 1, which That's is the right. district that Commissioner Myron sits in now. It's where I live in District 1, the west side of Portland. I love Multnomah County. I still love Multnomah County. Multnomah County is, in a lot of ways, it's the social safety net for, if you think about the last few thousand folks who generally fall through the cracks, right? Mm-hmm. And being that social safety net for folks is, I think, really important. And at the time, you know, 2015 was when that campaign kicked off. 2016, we were talking about homelessness, but we were talking about homelessness in a way that we had never thought, like what we see today on the streets compared to 8 years ago, it's really ballooned in a lot of ways. It's got more acute. It's more dangerous in a lot of ways for the public and those experiencing it. I mean, things have really amped up over the last few years. But at the time, we were still talking about those topics, right? We were talking about how to make sure that jail was not being, because Multnomah County runs the jails. We've got the DA, want to make sure that that's not being used as a way to criminalize, you know, black and brown folks in a way that white people were not being, as the historical wrongs that have been in that system. Like the county is the epicenter for so many areas where you can make progress as a community. So I wanted to do that. I wanted to be a part of that. And I wanted to represent my district of West Portland. I think that most people focus just on downtown, but West Portland, and actually Multnomah County's West District, is part of Savvy's Island all the way down to Washington County and your district and, you know, City of Tigard. And so there's a lot of diverse neighborhoods throughout that entire area. And I thought I could be a part of it. So I ended up in a runoff with Sharon Myron, who, it was a hell of a race, but she ended up giving me, I think, a good shellacking is the right term. And we've become close ever since. I mean, she's a close friend now, and we talk. In fact, I was in her office today. We see each other every day at work. So it was a loss, but it turned out great. And then I got to meet you because after that, I went and worked for the city of Tigard and another city in Oregon as an assistant city manager or deputy city manager, and got more on the appointed side versus on the elected side. And that was a great experience for a few years.
As someone who's also been on the receiving end of a shellacking, I can say, I think sometimes a shellacking is a useful thing in our lives and careers.
Yeah, I was young. Okay.
So there's a newspaper headline about you, Eric.
Oh boy.
And it is in Willamette Week. And I think it's from when you were running. I assume it's from when you were running. Here, I will just read it out loud and then you will have to explain yourself. Candidate Eric Zimmerman punched a man in the face, comma, says it was the right call. I think it stems from a 2011 incident, but this is like a prominent thing that pops up when you get Googled. So can you explain what that was about and why? How did that become part of the campaign too?
Yeah, I mean, I'm smiling. It was a really awful situation, but I'm laughing because the way that Willamette Week's brand, right? The way that they print stuff, and It was generally, it was 2011. This article is now almost 8 years old as well, because it was during the campaign. But essentially, my boyfriend and I were walking down the street, and this person just cold cocked my boyfriend at the time, like hit him so hard. He was, you know, kind of like out of sorts. Right. And I reacted, and it was just that simple. It was almost in that, I don't think about it reaction, but I stopped his attack and put him down, and he got his own whopping, and we got up and left. And my boyfriend at the time, you know, my focus was on him. You know, he was physically sick from the attack, and you know, throwing up, kind of that kind of sick. Because he really, you know, he hit him, you know, when you're not prepared to be assaulted like that, it really gets you. And so we went home and thought nothing of it other than how it was, right? And so later on, the person who had attacked my boyfriend, and I'm choosing not to say his name because he's not chosen to be in public life and we aren't dating anymore, so that's why I'm using that, not his name right now, but he was contacted by the police because that person wanted to file charges. Okay. And we were very confident that we had zero concern about that. So in one phone call with a police officer, and they were like, oh, okay, got it. You know, just told them exactly what happened. And they made it very clear that if that person really pushed charges, that they would file charges against him, but they would be pressing to file charges against him. And the DA and the police both said, absolutely not. And they let it go. So for me, I think of it as a nothing situation. How it became a thing 5 and 6 years later in an election, you know, I'll take the reporter at face value and say that it actually was read about, or the person saw me in the voter's pamphlet and recognized me. I don't know. That's what she reported, and that's fine with it. And that's how it was then part of the election. I will also say, and I don't want to badmouth this person too much, because they have a very long felony record and misdemeanor record, all sorts of attacks and all sorts of attacks against gay men.
Oh my God.
They were murdered in a very similar situation later on, where someone fought back. It is a really terrible story.
Whoa.
And so I took a certain brunt of it in 2016 because it worked for a certain political narrative. But like, this person was deeply disturbed. This person got away with a lot of fights and had hurt a lot of people over the years. And I think that I was unfortunate to be there. My boyfriend was unfortunate to be attacked, but fortunate enough that I was also confident in how to handle the situation. And sometimes violence finds you, and I took care of him. And so moved on from it. But it's been crappy, because you're right, it is the first thing that comes up when you don't have a super exciting Google profile. That is the first thing that comes up, and everybody knows it. So I'm okay talking about it, but I don't love it. And I think it's kind of a common narrative right now in the city of Portland, is like random violence that finds people on the street. And I've definitely lived it.
It's also one of those things where, you know, like when you choose to run for office, when you choose to put your name forward and say, I'll do this thing, that's when it comes out, right? Like if you are just in the guard and you're, you know, high ranking government employee, no one is talking about this 10 years later, it's something you probably moved on from. But because you are stepping up in a role to run for county commissioner, and anyone who runs for public office, and I think the higher up you go, the more that there's a search for like, what's the worst or weakest moment, or most potentially embarrassing, or even just sensational, explosive moment. And you have to, it's like, you know, they say that you're never done coming out. Like you're always, as a gay person, coming out. It's like, you never actually are able to move on. As long as you're running for office, like someone's going to ask you about it, which is a uniquely not cool part of running for office.
Well, and if you think about like our topic about don't ask, don't tell earlier, and you think about this is 2011 when this attack occurred, and I got in a scrap, and I did let my superiors know in the Army, like, hey, I got in this thing, but I was also delicate in how to deal with it, because was I going to tell them that it was an attack on a boyfriend, or was I going to like kind of shroud some of the personal details about how it occurred? But mostly I was okay. I was involved in a thing. I don't think it's going anywhere. I want you to be aware of it. I was very upfront. But those other things are out there because I couldn't really admit that it was a boyfriend, at least to my boss at the time. Yeah. You know, it was an unfortunate event for all of us. It was unfortunate for him. You know, he's probably somebody who could have benefited a lot from being in a place where he had some more mental health care, and he had a really long life of violence. And I think that you know, is a way too common of a story in Portland right now. But I think people get that today also in a way that maybe I wasn't sure how to you know, articulate the situation, you know, several years ago. But I think we understand it in Portland because I think we see it every single day on the streets, what we're talking about here.
Yeah. And that's a unfortunately good transition to what I want to talk about next, which is Portland. I think we use Portland as a placeholder for the region. I don't think people really are differentiating between Portland and the county and to some extent Metro. What do you think about Portland right now? What's the vibe? How are things going? Does it feel like things are getting better? Does it feel like things are stagnant? Does it feel like we're right before this big government change, so people are hopeful? Like, how would you describe the vibe of Portland in your political and social circles?
I mean, ultimately, I am definitely betting on Portland, right? I mean, it's when I came back from overseas in 2022 and I saw, you know, every corner of the city looked to me like it was in crisis, and downtown was a ghost town still. And that's when the mayor and his team asked me to come on and basically just run lead on trying to recover some aspect of downtown's livability, right? And at first we thought that would be like an economic thing, and it really quickly turned into a public safety and a confidence in government, that government could do the right thing, right? That when you called 911, you actually got an answer, that when you were assaulted, that somebody actually showed up. When I showed back up in Portland, I mean, that was not there. And we didn't have enough at the time. Some folks were speaking up from the political leadership areas, but like, we didn't have enough deep leadership moments where people said, I don't have to put up with this anymore, right? And so the mayor, to his credit, I think gave me a very long leash to do whatever it took to try and start making steps in the right direction for the city of Portland. And my role for him was the central city advisor. And it was a role unlike others where people had topical areas. I had a geographic area. So anything that touched it, I kind of weighed in on. And so I really, you know, it's why I'm betting on the city of Portland, because the number of people from the community who have been holding on, whether they were like small businesses, whether they were workers who, you know, rightfully are like, I'd love to come back, but every time I park down here, my window gets smashed, or I have to get yelled at by a person who is having a breakdown in the middle of the street just to walk into my office. And so why would I do that? But they've been holding out for years. Like, I mean, it's almost 2024. And how many times a week are all of us in some sort of meeting where someone blames the pandemic for the current situation? We're into it. So, you know, there's a new billboard in Portland, like Portland is what we make of it, or something along those lines. I believe that fundamentally. Like, I told a big group the other day, you know, we spend a lot of money as a community, whether you're in the hoteling industry or you're in the businesses, to advertise outside of Oregon about opportunities to come visit Portland, the tourism, all that kind of stuff. I think you take 5% of that budget and you start advertising to ourselves, right? To tell ourselves what our own story is, because most of the time when somebody comes down to Portland, especially like the central city for an event, but it's maybe been the first time they've been down there in years, they're having a positive experience. Right. It's lively. It's good to go to the tree lighting again. The music, the concert that you saw, the restaurants that you haven't been to in years are open, and the plastic between tables is down. And there are less tents in downtown Portland than there have been for years. And it's a good experience in a lot of ways. And then those stories are completely corrupted as soon as somebody goes back to their car and a window has been smashed open.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
And you take one step forward, and I think you take five leaps back when that occurs, because you've attacked their sense of belonging and being, and they're going to tell 20 of their friends. And so that's a problem. And in a lot of ways, Portland has improved, but where we deeply are, I mean, we're basically sliding into the river right now, are the open air fentanyl drug use. And it's not turning a blind eye, but it is trying to figure out, in a 110 world and in a world where, you know, we have a minimal amount of law enforcement, prosecutorial types of things you can do for the deeply illegal activity, which is like smoking in public. It's not about addiction at that point as much as it is like that activity was never legalized, but what do you do with it? And the effects that it has on people who are living on the street, but also people who have apartments but are spending all day on certain corners of Portland, is hellish. I mean, there are about 8 square blocks in Portland that are scary, and you can't defend against that. They're absolutely scary blocks. And we have to like get real about that. People are assaulted in those blocks. But to the point of your question, like, I'm betting on Portland. Because here's one thing where we've recovered almost pre-pandemic, the entertainment, the nightlife in Portland is back. The city of Portland instituted the entertainment district 2 summers ago because they needed to tackle an issue which was really dangerous in Old Town. We had shootings, right? Shootings. Put the entertainment district, we close off the roads. We've got cops who are dedicated to that district on weekend nights where they don't take other 911 calls, and shootings dropped from a ton to none, like just dramatically. The clubs are open. I know these guys who run these clubs, these hotel owners in that area. That part of our economy is back. What happens between 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. is a little less known right now, but I think we have got to get serious about more action on the ground. And I think that the politic of Portland, meaning like all of us as people, has hit the point where we're willing to say, I'm not willing to put up with that anymore. And that's giving, that's giving certain leaders just enough to say, okay, we may have gone a little too far in some enabling actions, and it's time to get really serious about what is acceptable, what is helpful, what is enabling, and start calling the difference between them and put stuff in place to right that ship.
I agree. There definitely seems to be a vibe shift in Portland. I think the Portland City Council, they like unanimously passed a resolution, basically like a trigger resolution that was like, as soon as the state enables criminalization of public consumption of drugs, that like Portland, which to have a 5-0 vote on council, like for that definitely would not have happened 2 years ago or 4 years ago. Here's my question for you. You're a rumored candidate for city council. I won't ask you whether you're in or you're out because I know you're still thinking about it. Although I will say this podcast would be a great place to make an announcement. You aside, what kind of leadership does Portland need right now? Do we need like decisive leadership? Do we need collaborative leadership? Do we need a good listener? Do we need someone who's not going to spend too much time listening and is going to act like there's this new form of government that no one quite is sure what to make of yet? Everyone's trying to develop their strategies to get their types of people elected to it. But I'm more curious about like what kind of person, what kind of style is an effective elected official in Portland? What do we need for those roles in 2023, given the dynamic that you just described?
The candidates that I'm looking at, the people who I'm hoping are successful, are people who are action oriented. And I mean that from an on the ground, whatever it takes to right the ship perspective. And I say that because I think that there is a time when government needs to get it perfectly right. And so studies and long processes make sense. There's also a time when those are highly inappropriate. And the times when they're inappropriate is when you're in crisis, or you could call it triage. And I think we're in that time. Right now is not a time for a deep study. Like the next mayor, the next city council, which will be 12 people, I think needs to take immediate action to shelter the homeless population, to bolster all the little micro like business districts across the city. So not just downtown, but like the St. John's downtown, the Hollywood district, the Woodstock district, and those little areas that, and the reason is if those are healthy, then it's kind of like it permeates out like a ripple in a lake, right? It permeates out and makes health in the rest of the neighborhoods. And Portland is really unique in that way because we have so many of those. If those are healthy, we take a big step in the right direction. But those are not, they don't have time to wait for a lot of performative studies or performative actions that give you watered down solutions. Like, you know what? Let's do some things. We're going to get some things right and we're going to get some things wrong. As long as when we get them wrong, we take our lick and we keep marching forward, right? That is the type of leadership that I'm looking for in electable leaders in the new city council, because that mindset will guide how they tackle the first year worth of work that they're going to have to do and how they're going to support a new city administrator and a new mayor to figure out the work between them, because it's a new hybrid system, and to get it together, Portland. Like, come on, like that is the area. The reason that matters, Ben, is that so the things I love about Portland are all the things that I'm like really bad at, and I'm glad there are other people in the community who do them well. Like, I love that this is a city that you can go have any type of meal you want because somebody is making it from whatever their culture is, from whatever their expertise is, you can find it here. I'm glad that in the city of Portland, you can go to any number of small neighborhood art exhibits and festivals and quirkiness all over the place because people are doing it. They're creative people in Portland. It is really hard to do that creative stuff, to make that like the Keep Portland Weird stuff. It doesn't have a breath right now because people are in crisis trying to repair the window they walked into that morning and found it was shattered as they came to work. or their employees are quitting because for the third week in a row, they were assaulted behind the counter, just being a host at a restaurant, right? The 6 months in and your hotel front desk has called 911 and doesn't get a response fast enough to deal with the crisis in their lobby. How do you be creative when you're dealing with crisis all day long, right? And so my goal for us as a city is that we take care of the crisis so that the creativity and the Portlanders who don't need to be experts in government can go do what they want to do and live in a way. But it's small stuff, right? We have toilets at parks in Portland that are closed, and next to them, we have placed a porta potty. If there is no greater indicator of failure of government, it might be those types of things, like the basics of our basic functions of government working. And it doesn't matter that you picked the most accessible toilet or the type bright color, it like open it up, get it, do something that works and move on to the next thing. And that was a lot of what I was trying to do in the mayor's office. And it's a lot of what the commissioner I work for now is how we're approaching like the county work, which is we've got deep problems. We've got to keep moving that direction. So I would love to have more teammates doing that and more allies on both sides of the river, the county and the city hall and county headquarters moving in that direction. So I'm looking at like those types of leaders. And there are a lot of them.
I'm going to ask you one follow-up here. This is my cheating question to get around asking you whether you're running or not. And then we're going to do one other topic. You seem like a relatively, you know, well-adjusted, normal guy. You've got a successful job. You don't have to run for office. Like, your life will be fine without running for elected office. How are you evaluating whether or not to do that? Like, what are you considering? Like, that there's two sides, right? There's the personal side. And I'm sure everybody who runs for office has to make like a financial decision about it. They have to make a decision about how comfortable they are with like their name and their history being in the newspaper, as we've discussed earlier. There's the stuff that's like unique and specific to you, but there's also the like, can I do anything with this job? Is this a useful way to spend my time? Like, you've got other leadership roles where you're already in government, you're serving your country. Like, I'm more interested in that second category of like, what are you thinking about? Like, what parts of the new city government are you considering? Like, that part of evaluating whether you do it or not.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to be coy. Like most people, and you're right, the paper has rumored about me. I am certainly considering it. I'm having a lot of those conversations, not just with my family, but like close friends. Like, is this something I'm ready to dive back into? And I'm leaning yes, you know, but there's a lot to consider because it's a new system. If I run, I'll be in a district where three of us would be elected to represent one district. So that's interesting. So what does that look like? A couple of things about the transition. I am so excited about the district model, like geographic districts. I know that there's been a lot of back and forth. I love them. I think they're so important, especially in an area where we won't be running bureaus the way that commissioners do today. So I think it's important. I think delivering for your constituency matters. It also allows you to be deeply responsive to their needs. And if you're in disagreement with another colleague because of that district constituent need, it's okay. It doesn't say anything about you as a person. It just says about the needs of your community. And I think that that's exciting for me personally. I like that. And what does bike transportation look like in your district? What does parks and recreation look like in your district? What does, you know, how do you get TriMet to adjust a certain route in your district? Those things matter. You know, your experience with Hall Boulevard and in Tiger, those are examples of like local involvement can make good changes, I think. And I think that has been somewhat lost in our community for a very long time because it's hard to put your energy into one geographic area out of that many square miles across the city and nearly 700,000 residents. So I'm thinking about that and whether I can be effective. I'm putting some value on the fact that I've been a deputy city manager for a couple of cities, and I have an idea for the challenge that that new role in the city of Portland is going to have. I think a lot of people are going to give them a hard time in a way that maybe is on the wrong topic or in the wrong manner. And I'd like to do what I can to make that next city manager successful. Mm-hmm. I also think that they're going to have to make a tremendous amount of decisions that are going to make them politically unpopular, but they're going to be the kind you have to make. And then they'll probably find their way to another thing within a few short years. And then the second city manager will be the one we have for a while, but they have to be made. And I want, if I can contribute to the city council, building on that relationship being a workable one and one that delivers on behalf of the city, then I think that's worthwhile. The city of Portland does not need to have 25 bureaus. It needs like firm leadership in a few areas, you know, a Department of Public Works probably versus four or five things that are broken up in our city that are not broken up in other cities. We have some streamlining that needs to happen, and I think I can help with that. But most of all, you know, I think what I would be considering is, does the field look like it will be a field of doers, right? Action-oriented people, and can I contribute to that or spur them to be more action-oriented as they take on the new transition? And I mean, that's where I'm considering stuff right now.
Well, we expect an announcement on this podcast if you decide to do it. Okay. Last like category question here. Multnomah County seems like a fun place to work.
It's a great place to work. I love it.
I say semi-sarcastically because the last few weeks there have been headlines about like fights happening among the commissioners, disagreements happening. One very prominent issue was this issue about Israel. And, you know, Israel was attacked in a terrorist attack by Hamas. And it's a very complicated situation in the Middle East with a lot of history. And this topic, this broad topic, got brought up before the commission. And it brought out a lot of feelings. It brought out a lot of people who have, I don't want to say, it's like everyone has their own understanding of Middle Eastern history and politics. And I think some people lack nuance in theirs, some people don't. But it was a whole thing at the county commission level. And turns out, I believe that they couldn't agree on how they want to do this. Eventually, a statement does get released by three county commissioners. And I think the county chair unilaterally decided to light the bridge. Is that how it happened in the Israeli flag colors?
Yeah, I mean, essentially, you know, as I said earlier, right, all executive powers at Multnomah County they rest with the chair. And so when the Morrison Bridge, which is a bridge that is lit often in Portland for various things that are important or signify a moment in time. So she made that call to light it in the blue and white colors. I will just say before I was there, they lit it for Ukraine after the invasion. And they lit it when I was there is when marriage equality was achieved. They lit it for that. They even lit it purple on the death of Prince, right? So there are highly, highly important geopolitical things. And there are other more localized. And there are other like just these are the things you do in certain months to recognize a moment.
So you in your, I think it was in your personal capacity, we should state, I will have stated this in the intro, but this interview with you is you as Eric Zimmerman. You're not representing anybody, including your boss. But I think it was your personal account where you tweeted your feelings about how this went down. Why does it matter so much to you? Why is it so important to you?
Yeah, I mean, I was going to transition and say that's the extent I'm going to talk about the Multnomah County experience. But my tweet it's actually, I mean, we're seeing it across all of the United States right now in terms of the political discord. Is, you know, first off, I don't think there are any mincing of words that what occurred in early October was a terrorist attack by a terrorist organization against a people. And I'm firm in that belief. I did not expect in the following days here locally or across CNN and all the other stations to watch such a contorting by certain political leaders to try and find some way to not call it terrorism. Mm. You know, I have listened now to so many accounts of families and what occurred on that day, to a mother talking about her son who was locked in a room with several others and is throwing the grenades back as they're lobbed into the room by Hamas terrorist fighters. That is so different. And I want to be really clear that when I'm speaking about this, you know, while everybody in the United States knows that a major is a tiny little person in the military system here, like I'm speaking for myself, I have no input on the DOD policies or the United States policies. Like this has absolutely nothing to do. I'm not speaking for them in any fashion. But, you know, if you were to just hear like major says this thing in another country, it could have some sort of like weight to it. There should be no weight to my statement. It's purely in Eric's feelings. But that have the feelings that you have about whether or not one country to another country is an appropriate relationship, right? In this case, Palestine, Gaza, and in Israel and their functions. And that, and our, I think our, as the United States, I think our perceptions of, as the lay folks has adjusted based on whether or not Israel's government was perceived as being conservative or more liberal at various times throughout my lifetime. Mm-hmm. I think that's a fair conversation and a fair debate. But I was really let down in so many ways that some people couldn't bring themselves to just put a line in the sand and say a terrorist act occurred. I don't remember in 9/11 time, and I don't remember that we expressed a whole lot of concern about why Al-Qaeda did what they did, or why Hamas in this case did what they did, but we are doing that for some reason right now. And I don't know that that's really a healthy thing at the beginning when folks are still trying to get their hostages back. Hearing the stories about what these families are going through, hearing the stories about, you know, the way that bombs were used, you know, grenades and gunshots to children in their bed. I have lived in an environment where insurgency and terrorists were operating. I have picked up the body parts of my own soldier. I know what this stuff feels like, smells like, sounds like. And I don't think that that is good for us as the United States to try and say there's a both sides issue to terrorism. I just don't think that was healthy. And I think people have confounded the geopolitical question about Palestinians and Israelis and that coexistence in that area to something that, and and some folks are ignoring the terrorist act. And I cannot help but think, and I cannot name another situation where that was the case as much as it is now. And it's got some deep anti-Semitic undertones to it. And I think we have to really talk about that and be serious about it, what that is, because nobody deserved what happened on October 7th. No one on earth deserved that. No one's children deserved that. No family deserved that because of what their country's geopolitical stance is. Hmm. And we have to be firm in that. And so, I mean, ultimately, I think I was let down. And I think that's what, you know, my tweet and my feelings about it were coming from, you know, from that basis.
I think that's an appropriate place to end it. We are coming up on a full hour with me. Lucky you. but thank you, Eric. I really appreciate you coming on. And I think you're a fascinating person. I hope you do run for Portland City Council. I think you'd be really good in that role. And I think Portland and all levels of government actually in this country right now need people to step up who are effective leaders. And I like you as a person too, so that helps. Thanks, folks want to learn more about you, they can't go to a campaign website though. Where are you going to direct them? Where's your plug? You get one plug at the end of the podcast. Where are you going to send them?
Oh, goodness. You know what? I think I'm on the Multnomah County website, and there's probably a good LinkedIn they can find me on. I'm a pretty searchable person, but yeah, there's no campaign websites yet.
Cool. All right, Eric, thanks for coming on. It's great talking to you.
All right. Thanks, Ben. Big fan.